Alrighty, so I got this going.
Yay. I'm ready to hear how to make my ideas clear, Don.
It may be a hopeless case of, you know. Just continuing the abuse, that's all. Well, yes, we're going to hear about how to make our ideas clear. And so this, we'll finish up Peirce. And I didn't bring any William James with me. So I want to, since we just went over half of it last time, I presume that that will take us the hour or whatever it is. Good morning. So let me kind of recap where we are with Charles Sanders Peirce. In a Peirce, what do I have the dates? 1813-1914, I guess. And he, of course, is regarded as the founder of the pragmatic school, even though, well, he called it pragmatism. He called his position pragmatism, actually. Of course, as I've said many times, it was William James who made Peirce famous. Peirce was by no means well known, except by fellow, he was mostly a logician. So by fellow logicians, he would have been known, but he certainly wasn't known popularly. He did write 6 essays in a magazine called the Popular Science Monthly. And they're kind of divided into 2 groups. The first 2 of them are sort of essays, general essays on epistemology, theory of knowledge. The last 4, which we're not going to talk about, are more about probability theory and stuff like that. So our interest is in the first 2.
Is this James that wrote these
Peirce. We're still talking about Peirce. And so last time we went over the first of the 2 essays, the one called The Fixation of Belief, remember? Mm-hmm. And just to really briefly recap that one, Peirce notes that Bonnie's on, I think. Is it Bonnie? No, it's not Bonnie either. It's,
yep.
Oh, yeah, it is Bonnie, yeah.
It is Bonnie.
Morning.
Morning.
Peirce notes that, he draws a distinction between doubt and belief. And he says, you know, doubt produces a state of mental discomfort, I guess you would say. And what we always want to, it's like a dissonant chord, I guess, in a sense, you know, and a dissonant chord wants to resolve itself into a nice consonance. Well, it's the same kind of thing here with doubt and belief. So doubt produces this cognitive dissonance. and of course, it wants to be resolved into something we can fix, a belief that we can fix on. And then he says, well, what are the methods of fixing belief? And he mentions 4, and we talked about this 4 last time. The first one he calls the method of tenacity. That's the one where it's the bumper sticker, you know, God said it, I believe it, and that settles it. I mean, at least in the case of religious belief. It doesn't have to be religious belief, of course. It could be any sort of belief, just as long as you decided, I'm going to believe this, regardless of evidence, regardless of what other people say. I'm going to shut out as much as I can any counter evidence or anybody else who says this is not true. I've just decided I'm going to believe it. I think Kierkegaard would be all for that. This is the method of tenacity, when you just decide to believe it and to heck with the rest of the world. And then another very effective method of fixing belief, remember, was the method of authority. And that one, of course, the church for centuries exercised that method quite a bit. And indeed, certainly saying things like I used to hear in elementary school, you know, which I don't think anybody in BUMC would support. But at any rate, back in elementary school, I was told, you know what I was told, I'm sure. I was told, you know, if you don't believe this, guess what? You know, you're going to rot in torment for eternity. So you better believe it. Well, that's a sort of an authoritarian move, I would say, to try to get somebody to believe something. And of course, naked power can also be wielded to force people to at least pretend to believe something, notably in societies where all the organs of communication are controlled by the government, all the newspapers, all the internet, and the whole deal, yeah, that goes a long way toward fixing belief, right? If you can control the information that people get, then you can, not 100%, but you can influence, certainly, people's beliefs. So authority is a second method of fixing belief. Neither of these, of course, is very palatable, or at least to a rationalist like myself. But anyway, yeah, they're out there. And they're probably more widely used than the other two methods. The third one is sort of the method of philosophical rationalism, according to Peirce. Now, Peirce is not sympathetic to the rationalists. He's much more sympathetic to the empiricist side. But at any rate, for Peirce, a third way of fixing belief is if something is just so... Well, that's the pitter-patter. Remember I was talking about the Sanskrit alphabet, and I was talking about how intellectually satisfying it is. Our alphabet, or indeed any of the other alphabets out there, the Phoenician, the Hebrew alphabet, the Arabic, the Latin, the Greek, they're all just this scattershot bunch of letters, right? No particular order to them. Just memorize your 26 letters, and that's that. But the Sanskrit alphabet has this beautiful symmetry about it, having to do with the points of articulation, whether it comes from your throat or the soft palate or the roof of your mouth or your teeth or your lips. And everything is organized in that way in a periodic table kind of structure. And it is very just intellectually satisfying. So, that sort of feeling that you get. And remember, a good example of that, I think, was Comte's philosophy of history, right? Three stages: the theological stage, the metaphysical stage, the positive stage. History is pretty complicated, right? And it just boils down to three stages. Boy, that's great. That simplifies it. I get it. It's pitter patter again. It's very intellectually satisfying. So, that would be I believe it. So that's the third method of fixing belief, right? Just the pure intellectual satisfaction, because we're rational beings, and if it just fits our reason somehow, very nice, like a key in a lock, then we want to believe it. So that's the third method. But, of course, that's not the most important one. The most important one is the method of science, according to Peirce. And the method of science involves experimentation, generalizing from our experiential data, et cetera, et cetera. And that's the best way of fixing belief. If you don't have that, he says, your second best one's the pitter-patter one, but really it's the method of empirical science that's the best. So that was the gist of that particular essay. And now we move on to how to make our ideas clear. So, go ahead, sure.
And did he say by that method you could find faith?
Actually, yes. Peirce wrote a series of little articles also on religion, and among the various things he says about it, one is to gripe about Auguste Comte, the positivist. Pragmatism is an offshoot of positivism, but you got positivism person one, positivism person two, right? Various subgroups might not agree with one another. And so and we'll see this in just a second, really, in a few minutes. His big gripe about Comte's positivism is precisely that it excludes religion. In other words, that he thinks that Comte drew this circle much too small. You know what I mean? I keep on saying, and up to you and Tom and people who've asked that kind of question, well, it depends on how big you draw this circle, right? Mm-hmm. And you look at somebody like the logical positivist in the 1930s, it's pretty darn small, and all sorts of things are out here. You look at the pragmatists, though, they were kind of arguing for expanding the circle, and William James certainly is doing that, too, as we'll see. So, it just depends. Uh-huh. We talk about positivism. Positivism is not necessarily anti-religious. It can be, but not necessarily. And it isn't for the Americans, interestingly. But maybe that's because they were Americans. You know? didn't Tocqueville say in his famous work about the Americans, didn't he say something about Americans are just so religious? I think he did. Is that, am I, or am I making, or is that somebody else that said that? Anyway, somebody remarked that. Maybe it isn't a surprise that when the Americans got hold of positivism, they wanted to loosen things up a bit. So Peirce has this, it seems to me like a kind of a argument from design type thing for the existence of God, for example. It says if you go out into the woods and just kind of let everything go, you know, don't even think about things too intellectually, you just can't help but feel that it's all sort of purposeful somehow. That's pretty vague. There it is. So anyway, let's see how to make. Tom wants to know how to make his ideas clear, and so we're going to help Tom out here by reading some words of wisdom from Peirce's essay on how to do just that. And you'll see here this interesting. You'll see how the pragmatic theory just kind of comes out of this whole question of belief. Right? I mean, this is the sequel to the fixation of belief. So we've been talking about how you get the belief. But what is a belief and all that sort of thing? You'll see in just a second. And then you'll see the connection between that and actually pragmatism per se. It's not obvious initially, but you'll see some of the dots to be connected in this essay. Let's see here how I'm going to start. We may add that just as a piece of music may be written in parts, each part having its own air, so various systems of relationship of succession subsist together between the same sensations. These different systems are distinguished by having different motives, ideas, or functions. Thought is only one such system, for its sole motive, idea, and function is to produce belief. Okay, so we start with sensations because, of course, that's the fourth method of fixing belief. And then these thoughts supervene. So how do we get from the sensations to the belief? I guess is kind of what he's saying. And so these thoughts supervene. And the sole purpose of thoughts is to fix belief. Okay. But the soul and meaning of thought abstracted from the other elements which accompany it, though it may be voluntarily thwarted, can never be made to direct itself toward anything but the production of belief. This is a restatement of what we just heard. Thought in action has for its only possible motive the attainment of thought at rest. Thought in action has for its only possible motive the attainment of thought at rest. And whatever does not refer to belief is no part of the thought itself. And what then is belief? Ah, yes, that's the question. What then is belief? And here is how we start approaching pragmatism, as we'll see. What is belief? It is the demicadence which closes a musical phrase in the symphony of our intellectual life.
A demi what?
Cadence. Oh. A cadence is like an ending to something. You know, when you reach the end of a piece, say, or the end of a phrase even, there's sort of, you can hear it, and you know what I mean? You know, it's one of these things, you know what it is when you hear it, right? Mm-hmm. And everything is, you can tell it's about to resolve itself, and sure enough, you know, we wind up, like at the end of the anthem we're going to sing this morning, just think how it ends up. You know, even if you've never heard it before, you know you're about at the end, and then it just, everything, you know. And that's what, by the way, I'm really getting off the subject, but you ever heard the term deceptive cadence? A deceptive cadence, a cadence is just a technical word in music, meaning you're falling toward the end, you're just falling toward a state of rest. But a deceptive cadence, which is a very clever musical little trick, is to create the expectation that you're just about the end, and then you hit a chord that's not the tonic,
right,
and you got to start all over again, or go off here and then come back, or whatever, and that's... But anyway, yeah, that's what a cadence is. And so he says, thought is kind of like that. It's kind of like a musical work. And what you want to do is come to rest, just like a piece of music. So thought then is this, he's got a demi-cadence, halfway, sort of a cadence, you know. in the symphony of our intellectual life. We have seen that it has just three properties. Okay, that's good. For three properties. First, it is something we're aware of. Second, it appeases the irritation of doubt. Remember, that's the whole thing about doubt. Doubt is inherently an uncomfortable state, and you want to replace it with belief. Right? So thought appeases the irritation of doubt because you're going. Thought is the dynamic part of all this, and you're going in that direction. But the third one is the one that's really important. And third, it involves the establishment in our nature of a rule of action, or, say for short, a habit. Okay. In other words, a belief is going to be connected to, say, rules for action or habits. That's interesting. Let's see what he says about that. As it appeases the irritation of doubt, which is the motive for thinking, thought relaxes and comes to rest for a moment when belief is reached. But since belief is a rule for action, the application of which involves further doubt and further thought, at the same time that it is a stopping place, it is also a new starting place for thought. That is why I have permitted myself to call it thought at rest, although thought is essentially an action. The final upshot of thinking is the exercise of volition, and of this, thought no longer forms a part. But belief is only a stadium of mental action and effect upon our nature due to thought, which will influence future thinking. So here's the progression. I mean, you might say we start off with doubt. That's an inherently uncomfortable state. We then bring in thought, because we want to resolve our doubt. And the way to do that is to think about it, to figure out where things really stand. And ultimately, we will wind up producing belief. But what is belief? Well, it's something that didn't just sit there, right? I mean, we often say that if you believe something, it's really going to affect how you act in the world, right? I mean, beliefs are not just irrelevant to what we do, right? If they were, we wouldn't be so concerned about what people believe, one thing. I mean, heck, in a church, your Christian faith should lead you to X, Y, and Z type actions, that sort of thing. So we're not just going to sit here with a bunch of beliefs. What's the point? Unless there's some, and indeed, is it even possible to have a belief that is not somehow linked with something you do? So that's why he says it's kind of like a habit. It will lead to a certain class of actions that indeed do sound like something that's habitual because it stems from this internal state that we call belief. See what I mean?
You seemed to say a minute ago that volition was antithetical to habit. Use the word volition.
I did, or he did?
Well, he did. Maybe I'm wrong, but that's
volition.
What I understood
the
you
word
to say.
Volition.
Volition and thought.
Yeah, right.
Thought no longer has a part. Thought no doesn't have a part in volition.
Oh, that was at the very end. Very end, right? The final upshot of thinking is the exercise of volition, and of this thought no longer forms part. Yeah, right. In other words, the idea. Let me draw it on the board.
So you're already there, in other words.
Yeah, that's right. Let's see, what do I. I need this picture, right? I need the circle. Can't do. Oh, I don't need. Oh.
Thanks, Jay.
Oh, well.
We need to go back to a blackboard and talk.
Yeah, I know. All right, let me just. Here, I'll use this little white space in here. So we have doubt. And that's an uncomfortable state, of course. And so therefore we start thinking. So thought is next. And I'll do a new line here. And that leads to belief, which, as he says, could lead of course, as science frequently does, to further questions, right, and further doubts, and then further thought, and further belief, et cetera, that sort of thing. And that's certainly true. So I could actually draw another arrow like that, because it can be a cycle. But also, belief leads to, I'll use his word habit, which leads to action, let's say. And this is where the volition comes in, right? Or I could even put volition in there and then say action. You want me to do that just to get the word volition in there? I can do that too. Volition. And then action. So in other words, thought is not volition. And when you get to this stage, you're past the thought part of it, at least as he's using it here, which is the process of going from doubt to belief. Now, if you were to ask Aristotle, for example, I mean, thought is integrally involved in action because you have to figure out means to ends and all that sort of thing. And I'm sure Peirce would say the same thing, but he's using in this particular sequence, he's using the word thought simply to refer to whatever, the dynamic entity that gets you from doubt to belief, right? That's it. So it has this, it's a movement type thing, as he says. It's essentially a motion, so to speak. Does that make sense?
Mm-hmm.
You know,
Thank you.
So I mean, of course, it's not the same as volition, right? Because it's a different stage. But you see, this is what's really important, because you know what he's saying is that once you have a belief, somehow it's going to affect how you live. Yeah, it's not just going to sit there in theory land or something like that. It's going to have practical or pragmatic effects. Okay? Alrighty, where am I? The essence of belief is the establishment of a habit. So that's why. The essence of belief is the establishment of a habit. And different beliefs are distinguished by the different modes of action to which they give rise. Okay? If beliefs do not differ in this respect, if they appease the same doubt by producing the same rule of action, what is he going to say? What's the then part of that clause? Somebody tell me, what's he going to say? I'll read that if part again. I'll read the if part again. If beliefs do, the previous sentence, you know, had said that beliefs are distinguished by the different modes of action to which they give rise, and then this sentence starts. If beliefs do not differ in this respect, if they appease the same doubt by producing the same rule of action, then...
That's religion?
No.
Then belief doesn't make any difference.
Okay, well, two beliefs that result in the same rule of action...
Are the same belief.
Exactly. I mean, so it doesn't make any... You're right, it doesn't make any... But yeah, that's... But logically, then, they're the same belief. Now you see how we're inching our way toward how to make our ideas clear. So if we have two beliefs that seem to be different, but darn it, we work things out and we're at this stage and they wind up being the same thing, they're really basically the same belief. They may be in different words or whatever, but they're really the same, right? Now that we've clarified what our ideas are, and we've clarified what our ideas are by looking at their practical effects. See. So yeah. So they.
Don.
Yeah.
Don.
Yeah. Go ahead.
Don.
Thanks.
Those of us on the Zoom field are having a lot of technical difficulties this morning, and you're freezing more or less at the same time for all of us. So I think the problem is that I don't see it on my screen, but others are telling me that their screens are saying your bandwidth is low.
Well,
so
if you see some of
us pop off.
Okay.
Because
you know,
yeah, I'm missing about half your sentences every third sentence.
Oh, you know what?
So I may just have to listen to the recording.
Okay. You know, I let me say this. I had a hard time getting on this morning. When I got on, it said, session has been closed by host. So I had to try it again. I got on that time, And then what happened? Something else weird happened. I forget. I don't know. I don't know if something else is going on in the church that somehow...
Max had to clean up from the praise in the parking lot service, so he hasn't been, for one thing, working it.
Yeah.
That's probably...
Yeah,
that's,
I don't know, something else.
Probably what's going on, Max.
Fluttering thing.
Yeah, like Don, Lonnie, you're quite clear to me, and Don is jerky.
Huh.
Yeah, well, that's not surprising. You're clear to me as well.
All right, well, I'm sorry. Just let's do the best we can.
Hey, Don, can I ask a question about what you just said about belief?
Yeah.
So, can I bring up our buddy Copernicus again?
Sure.
So the whole thing about, you know, the sun or the earth or whatever as the center of the universe, that's not a belief because it doesn't affect our daily lives.
No, but it does, but it is a belief. Oh, I see what you, I see what you mean. For in other words, it doesn't matter if I believe the sun.
I take no action different based on whether it is true or false.
You know. I think, okay.
The action by which you calculate the orbits of the planets under those kind of models are very different as a result, and that belief does matter.
But yeah.
From a scientific
but I
point
don't.
Of view, not a moral view.
Right. But you know, I also think that the idea of the practical effect business... I know he's putting it in terms of what you call the moral view or the rule of action or the you know, what we actually do. But I think he would also encompass under that effects in the observational differences. So, for example, right, I mean, kind of like the logical positivist would say, okay, you have the Copernican view here, you have the Ptolemaic view here. Do they predict different observations? And that has nothing to do with my action or something like that. So I guess what I'm saying is I think it's broader than it sounds like it is here, and Tom is jumping on the way it's put here. But I think Peirce would also include under the practical effects the kinds of observational differences you would have if you had two different theories. Does that make sense? See what I'm saying? For example, let me give you an example. But that's a really good example because it's not the kind of thing that that directly affects maybe how we act in the world, but it does affect the way the world behaves and the way and things that we would observe. So, for example, one of the big deals was back in the day, critics of Copernicanism said, "Okay, if Copernicanism is true, we should see phases of Venus. We should see Venus in space. There should be a half Venus and a full Venus and a new Venus and that sort of thing. Why? Well, if Copernicanism is true, if we were at 90 degrees, if the sun is here and Venus is here and we're here, we would see a half Venus. If we're here, sun here, and Venus is practically on the other side, we'd see a full Venus, et cetera, et cetera. But we don't. We just see Venus. So there's a problem there. Well, you see, that's an observational difference. But guess who figured it out? No, Galileo. Because he used the telescope. And when he used the telescope, then you can see phases of Venus. Guess what? But that's a practical difference. It's not a difference in human behavior, but it's a difference in the behavior of nature, I guess I would say. You know? So in that sense, there is still a difference between the Ptolemaic theory and the Copernican theory. Does that make sense, Tom?
Well, I'm not sure where you were coming down on the answer to my question about fact versus belief. You know, I mean, like Don, we could talk about all kinds of science, like the Big Bang and string theory and stuff that are unproven. They can't be proven. So are they beliefs, facts, or what?
Oh, they're beliefs, but I think the point is, what I'm trying to say is, we refer to an action here, but I tell you what, I think Peirce would say this is a special case of a larger category that I can just call practical effects. So I say Copernicanism versus Ptolemaic theory. Maybe it doesn't... Go ahead. Yeah, were you going to say something?
Yeah, maybe the distinction is how it affects my life versus the world in general.
Yeah, exactly. And what I'm saying is when we talk about the practical effects of a belief or of a theory even, I think he would say it's really broader than just action. Like Ruben said, I think you said moral action or something like that. I think he would say, if there are two, I think this is a parallel kind of statement. If there are two theories out there and they all have the same predictions, then there's no difference between them.
Right. It's like the different interpretations of quantum mechanics.
Yeah, kind of like that.
Well, I wouldn't agree with that at all.
Oh, okay. Why?
I mean, you can have different theories that predict behavior of things in the real world that theories have nothing to do with each other.
The things in the world or the theories?
For example, string theory versus some other counterexample theory.
But end up
with the same result.
But a scientist, but a physicist would really say, I think a physicist would put on the positivist hat here, logical positivist, and say, if there's no difference between these two theories and what they predict, as Ruben said a second ago, they're really the same theory. I mean, they're in different words or whatever, but you gotta... That's the whole point of testing theories. They have to have some sort of predicted outcomes, and if two theories have all the same predicted outcomes, well, what's the practical difference between them? Emphasis on practical. Yeah.
Does this hold true for religious beliefs as well?
It would.
Two religions have the outcome that people are performing charitable acts. Is that?
Yes, that's the whole thing. I'm glad Tom asked the question because I think it does bring out that the way Peirce is talking here is more confined than he had in mind. I think he had the big practical effects type thing. But you're right. One of the motives, I think, for the pragmatists in expanding this circle here is to bring in considerations just like that. Because we'll see with William James, that's the whole thing, right? It's the practical effects of the belief, whatever it is. And those could indeed be moral. It's a huge category, right? I mean, it includes the faces of Venus, but it includes charitable giving. Right. All are practical effects.
What I interpreted that to mean was that if you get the same action, it means that the two beliefs are the same. And
yeah.
I was thinking of, no, wait a minute, a perfect atheist can still do charitable acts.
Yeah, but...
Because they think it's the practical thing to do.
Right.
Or because, and have no religious belief.
Right, but those aren't the only actions either that are affected by religion, right?
Yeah, but the belief is not the same.
Right. I was thinking more Islam and Christianity, but yeah, you can extend that to atheism
those are not the only actions people engage in. So a theist might come to church, say, but an atheist won't. I mean, there are other actions, too, that would differentiate theism from atheism. Not charitable giving isn't the only action people do, right, of course.
No.
But they must share some set of beliefs, though.
Yeah, that is true. That is true.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, and just historically, of course, Christianity has affected our ethical views, even if we're purely secular people. That's just a fact of history. But anyway, I think that the language here is part of a more general claim that if we're talking about scientific theories or we're talking about beliefs or whatever, it's always the practical effects that is the telltale sign of what the darn thing means. And as I say, remember, and I mentioned this before, the logical positivists in the 1930s, their slogan was, the meaning of a statement is its method of verification. And of course, they're thinking of a scientific theory, and they're saying, okay, what does this theory mean? Well, what it means then is, if you look in this place, this is what you'll see, that sort of thing. That's what its true meaning is. Well, that's basically the same thing Peirce is saying. What are the practical effects? The only difference is the logical positivist formulation was much more, much narrower than this, vague term, practical effects. Right? Because practical effects include an awful lot of stuff. Whereas the logical positivist said, we say, we're talking about observation statements. Well, that's a narrower kind of practical effect. If you just say practical effects in general, that could be anything, right? So anyway, yeah, that was a great question, though, Tom. So here's how to make your ideas clear. Before I tell you how to make your ideas clear, I'll just read a couple of more sentences, and then we'll get to the main sentence in here. This is just sort of fleshing out everything we've heard so far. Now, the identity of a habit depends on how it might lead us to act, but under such as might possibly occur, no matter how improbable they... I'm sorry, I missed a line. No wonder it didn't make any sense. Let me start over again. Now, the identity of a habit depends on how it might lead us to act, not merely under such circumstances that are likely to arise, but under such as might possibly occur, no matter how improbable they may be. What the habit is depends on when and how it causes us to act. As for the when, every stimulus to action is derived from perception. As for the how, every purpose of action is to produce some sensible result. Thus we come down to what is tangible and conceivably practical. As the root of every real distinction of thought, no matter how subtle it may be, and there is no distinction of meaning so fine as to consist in anything but a possible difference of practice. So then we come, finally, to the central sentence of how to make our ideas clear. This is how to make your ideas clear. And it was this sentence that William James picked up on and made Peirce famous. Here it is. It appears, then, that the rule for attaining the third grade of clearness of apprehension is as follows. Consider what effects that might conceivably have practical bearings we conceive the object of our conception to have. Then, our conception of these effects is the whole of our conception of the object. So I'll read it again. Consider what effects that might conceivably have practical bearings we conceive the object of our conception to have. And that, by the way, could include Copernican heliocentrism, as well as religious belief. Then our conception of these effects is the whole of our conception of the object. So, my ideas, what does this idea really mean? Well, consider the practical effects of it in that very, very broad sense. That is the sum total of the meaning of that idea, or that maybe that belief, right? Or that theory even. But I mean, it's broader here. The idea, the meaning of the idea consists in its practical effects. Otherwise, you're not too clear on exactly what you're thinking. Right? And that was the motive, as I say, behind the logical positivist too. Why do I want to reduce every theory to observation statements? Well, to clarify what the theory is really saying. Same deal here. Consider what effects that might conceivably have practical bearings we conceive the object of our conception to have. Then our conception of these effects is the whole of our conception of the object. So that is the, I guess you'd say, the pragmatic rule. How does Peirce... Any comments, questions, or anything? What does Peirce think about this? I mean, what is his assessment of his statement about how to make your ideas clear? He wrote a later essay titled "What Pragmatism Is," and this is the one where he starts going off using the word pragmaticism. And I'll read something else in just a minute. But anyway. The gist of this particular essay is, here's a question about pragmatism, here's my answer. Here's a question, here's my answer, that sort of thing. Well, anyway, this is one of his answers. It will serve to show that almost every proposition of ontological metaphysics is either meaningless gibberish one word be defined by other words, and they still by others, without any real conception ever being reached. In other words, no practical effects. or else it's downright absurd. So that all such rubbish being swept away, what will remain of philosophy will be a series of problems capable of investigation by the observational methods of the true sciences. So here we're actually talking about non-personal, non-moral action. We're talking about the broad meaning of practical effects. And then he goes on to say this. In this regard, pragmaticism, he's renamed it, remember, by then, pragmaticism is a species of prope-positivism, near-positivism. So here it's explicitly recognized that what we have in pragmatism or pragmaticism is a subspecies of positivism. But among the various subspecies, of which Comte is one and mine is one and goodness knows who is which, that sort of thing, how do they argue with one another? Well, guess here it comes. But what distinguishes it, pragmaticism, from other species is, first, its retention of a purified philosophy. I'm not sure what he means by that, but we'll go on to second. Its full acceptance of the main body of our instinctive beliefs. And thirdly, its strenuous insistence upon the truth of scholastic realism. Well, this business about instinctive beliefs is certainly something that no narrow positivist would ever countenance. And this is one of the reasons why, as I say, both Peirce and James draw that circle much bigger than Hume and Kant did, you know, because it's going to include, well, Hume talks about instinctive beliefs, actually, but we have 5 minutes. But the logical positivist certainly would have no truck with instinctive beliefs. So anyway, he's pointing out here that this pragmaticism, or his original pragmatism, is something that is going to include a lot more than, say, Auguste Comte. That was the narrow version of positivism that he was aware of in his day, was Comte's anti-religious narrow circle here that excludes an awful lot of stuff. A little bit later, he is talking about his philosophical development, or I should say the development of the pragmatic school. And this is what he says. About 40 years ago, my studies of Berkeley and Kant and others led me, after convincing myself that all thinking is performed in signs and that meditation takes the form of a dialogue, so that it is proper to speak of the meaning of a concept, to conclude that to acquire full mastery of that meaning, it is requisite, in the first place, to learn to recognize the concept under every disguise through extensive familiarity with instances of it. But this, after all, does not imply any true understanding of it, so that it's further requisite that we should make an abstract logical analysis of it into its ultimate elements, or complete an analysis as we can compass. But even so, we may still be without any living comprehension of it, and the only way to complete our knowledge of its nature is to discover and recognize just what general habits of conduct, a belief in the truth of the concept, or of any conceivable subject under any conceivable circumstances, would reasonably develop. That is to say, what habits would ultimately result from a sufficient consideration of such truth. It is necessary to understand the word conduct here in the broadest sense. If, for example, the prediction of a given concept were to lead to our admitting that a given form of reasoning concerning the subject of which it was affirmed was valid, when it would not otherwise be valid, the recognition of that effect in our reasoning would be decidedly a habit of conduct. Well, anyway, in 1871, in a metaphysical club in Cambridge, Massachusetts, I used to preach this principle as a sort of logical gospel, representing the unformulated method followed by Berkeley, and in conversation about it, I called it pragmatism. In December 1877 and January 1878, I set forth the doctrine in the Popular Science Monthly, and the two parts of my essay were printed in French, blah, blah, blah. Okay, we don't care about that. Of course, the doctrine attained no particular attention. For, as I had remarked in my opening sentence, very few people care for logic. But in 1897, guess who? Professor James remodeled the matter and transmogrified it into a doctrine of philosophy, some parts of which I highly approved, while other and more prominent parts I regarded and still regard as opposed to sound logic. About the time, and then something else happened, anyway, he then says, I was coming to the conclusion that my poor little maxim should be called by another name. And accordingly, in April 1905, I renamed it Pragmaticism. And then he ends by saying this, I trust I shall be believed when I say that it is only a desire to avoid being misunderstood in consequence of my relations with pragmatism, and by no means as arrogating any superior immunity from error, which I have too good reason to know that I do not enjoy, that leads me to express my personal sentiments about their, William James and Company, tenets. Their avowedly undefinable position, if it be not capable of logical characterization, seems to me to be characterized by an angry hatred of strict logic and even some disposition to rate any exact thought which interferes with their doctrines is all humbug. So you get the picture here. Of course, Peirce came up with the idea first, but nobody paid it much attention until 1897 or whatever, whenever it was, that William James popularized it. And but William James is more of a loosey-goosey kind of thinker than Peirce was. And Peirce was a logician, first and foremost. And so Peirce reacted against that looser form of pragmatism, and thus he renamed his position Pragmaticism. So now that we have some little bit of introduction, at least through Peirce's eyes, of what William James is doing, then next week we'll actually start with William James. So how about that?
2 months later.
Yeah.
You've got somebody new in here, and I can't tell who
this. No, that's... Oh, yeah, sure.
There's been four squares up there forever.
Oh, well, Bonnie's not there anymore.
Well, that's what I'm saying. Now you've got an extra square.
Thanks, Tom.
See ya. Bye-bye.